This is Countryfile Live 2019, the podcast that lets you relive some of the best moments from the talks and presentations that happened in the National Trust Theatre at this year's BBC Countryfile Live event at Blenheim Palace. In this series, you'll hear from the likes of Ray Mears on the best time to get involved with nature, from J.B. Gill on his transition from fame to farming, and from Timothy Bentinck, a.k.a. David Archer, who gives us a peek behind the scenes of The Archers. In this episode, we join Countryfile presenter Charlotte Smith in conversation with Alan Power, National Trust head gardener from Stourhead, and Carol Klein from Gardener's World. They're going to answer your gardening queries and share their passion for the joys of gardening.
So firstly, I just want to talk about why, for you, there is joy in gardening, Alan.
It goes right back. It goes right back to when I was a child. And I think, to be honest, the joy of gardening is the language that it gives you. You know, you can talk to anybody who's interested in plants or start a conversation about a plant or a place or an element of nature that is engaging for that person. You know, any gardener in the audience here, we can talk a language of passion and interest that is boundless. And it goes beyond the countries, doesn't it? You can talk about plants from all over the world. And that's what I really enjoy. You know, I've had it since I was a little child, and I've married a gardener. It's that bad. And she's around somewhere, but it is wonderful. It's a wonderful thing to have.
Carol, where's the joy in it for you?
It's one of the very few real things you actually do in your life. It's not through a machine or technology or walking on concrete or tarmac or looking at a screen. It's actually helping things to grow and being able to enjoy them. And it's vital, I think. It's something that everybody should do, even people who kill mint.
Right. Yeah, I have to confess, I did kill mint. I had it because someone said to me it will grow a lot. So I put it in a pot and it died. And apparently, mint is the one thing that's really hard to kill.
It's indestructible. Yeah.
So you need to share the secret.
I found that very easy to do. This is why I don't garden. We've been talking today in the tent about nature and well-being. And actually, I've been really surprised by the number of conservationists in particular who've said that the first place they got into nature was the garden. And actually, how important for nature gardens have become. So it's something you're very aware of now, Alan.
Oh, totally. And I think in terms of our access into gardens, gardens are a gateway. You know, they're either a gateway into a historic house or into your own house or a gateway out into the countryside. And it's such an important transition for so many different elements, you know, of beetles and bugs and bits of deadwood, and the habitat start and finish sometimes within the garden, not outside the garden. And I think there are vital crossroads in that link between the countryside and our domestic environments that we live in.
I think that whether you know it or not, whether you do it deliberately or not, we all share our gardens with so many other creatures, and it becomes more and more incumbent on us to do as much as we possibly can to make sure that our gardens offer as much hospitality to as many different creatures and as many different plants as possible. It's the way to go. We've all got to try and do it.
Gardening obviously has become your job. Do you still get joy from your garden at home and gardening it?
Oh, yes. As much as I was just talking to Alan about this, as much as I'm enjoying being here, I'm really dying to get home and get out in my garden. It's always joyous. You know, there's always an element of there are things to do and things you want to do, and every so often you just have to stop yourself just to make sure you really appreciate, you know, what your garden is for you. But I love it. I love everything about it. I love it. You know, the very first time I can remember my mum. Sorry, I'll get all sentimental. I can remember my mum pressing a nasturtium seed into my hand and, you know, showing me how to plant it. I must have been about 3 or 4, something like that. And then seeing these twin leaves, you know, coming out, she took me out and looking at them. And then finding this plant that just grew and grew and then had wonderful flowers. And then collecting seeds myself and putting it in a paper bag and saving it till next year. Yeah.
Now, you have a very big garden to look after professionally. Do you actually have a garden at home that you have time to even think about?
Yeah, we have. And like I said, my wife's a gardener, so it's a garden that's argued over. You know, plants arrive home and you have to make decisions on where things are going, and it doesn't often happen that quickly. But honestly, we have a little boy at the moment as well, so we don't get an enormous amount of time. But when we do, we go out the back door of the garden and we go our separate ways. And we'll garden in a corner, and it is therapy. You spoke about well-being, and you capture moments in a garden where you'll utterly get lost. And it can be weeding, hedge cutting, planting, digging a border through, changing what you're doing. Whatever it is, whatever the task, you will lose yourself. And that's what I find about gardening at home. It is therapy.
That's one of its hugest benefits, isn't it? I mean, there are lots spoken about well-being and mental health, but it's always been the case that once you get there and you get involved with it, because it's not because it makes demands of you, but you know, there are certain things that you've got to do. You become so involved with it that you do forget about, you really do forget your troubles.
How many of you here would agree with that? That gardening is, oh wow, I should maybe try it. Let's talk just briefly about Stourhead. How many people have been? Okay, so I'm just going to read what the National Trust says about it. Yeah, you've been. Henry the Magnificent was a modest man. No, it doesn't say that. Henry the Magnificent was one of a small group of early 18th century gentleman gardeners using their acres to create a particularly personal landscape, expressing their hopes and beliefs about the world and their journey through it. Which is wonderful, isn't it? How do you go about working with that and the sheer amount of space?
Well, it's 2,500 acres that we cover in terms of the designed landscape. But for me, all of my hints and clues come from Henry the Magnificent and his grandson, Richard Cold Hoare. Their letters to people who visited their garden when they were alive, people's reactions, their true responses to the place. So I can go back and try and recreate some of the scenes, some of the planting schemes, keeping the views open, letting views disappear, and keeping the garden alive and dynamic, so that hopefully when you visit Stourhead, you don't get to see Alan Power's Stourhead, you see Henry the Magnificent's Stourhead. And that's my job, for you to experience what he wanted you to see as a visitor.
Is that not for you ever so slightly frustrating?
Not at all.
Really? Don't you want to do, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful if we did something radical in that corner?
Not really, because I was lucky enough when one of my first professional jobs in horticulture was in a garden restoration project in Essex a long time ago. And I luckily discovered this relationship horticulture and gardening can have with magnificent stories that can span hundreds of years. And I'm just on, today is the last page, and we're writing the next page of that magnificent story. And that's all I'm doing. 300 years of history at Stourhead and 300 years before that to get to that point. And I'm just writing the last page of what I'm doing at Stourhead. And
we're
just continuing.
But you will be, somebody else will be continuing. Yeah. And if you don't mind my saying so, you're a very poetic and sensitive sort of bloke who can actually cope and manage to do that. But at the same time, your garden is a living thing too. So it's not a question of maintaining a still picture. It is still a question, because nature does that, plants do that, of it developing and moving and changing, albeit in the, you know, in within the bounds of what he had originally, or they had originally,
and it
intended.
And it is that. We refer to Stourhead as a living work of art or a masterpiece, and we're restoring the picture. And through what we do, we're just trying to make that picture that little bit better. And it's great fun. And I hope that in 300 years' time, somebody else is still doing it. So it's brilliant.
When you're designing gardens and thinking about gardening, what's the key to it if you're going to make it a joy and not a burden?
Understanding what you've got, first of all, whether it's, you know, something the size of this stage or half as big. Understanding what your soil's like, what the situation's like, and therefore what you can grow. I mean, your own taste, of course, impinges on that. But whoever you are and however you garden, that, you know, nature comes first. That you have to follow natural laws or your garden's a flop. It won't work. Your mint will die.
Yes.
You should have, I think you should just get some more mint and just try again. Sink a big pot into the ground this time.
Oh, okay.
So your mint can't escape, but nonetheless it's connected to what's around it. And water it frequently.
Who knew?
Hello, my name is Kate. And I was wondering kind of what you said earlier about making your garden better for nature around it. We have a 10-foot by 10-foot patio that's very much in the city. So how could we take that space and make it best for our surroundings to try and bring a bit of nature into something that's a bit concrete?
Have you got any soil?
In a pot.
Just in pots. So the whole thing is, it's hard landscaping and it's...
Yeah.
And how big is it? About 10 by 10?
Yeah, so when you said half the stage.
Right. And yeah. Is it surrounded by buildings, trees? What's it like as far as sun and shade go?
It's south-facing and we've got 2 brick walls, so it's quite a warm spot.
Right. So make use of your walls, first of all. But if you do, because you've got no soil, you're going to have to use containers and you're going to have to use soil, if possible, sorry. If you're filling them with compost, if you can't get hold of topsoil, then use John Innes 3, mentioning no names. It's not a brand, it's a formula. I'm not advertising. Because as soon as you put a plant in a pot, it's deprived of that opportunity to spread its roots into the soil. So it's really important that your pots are as big as possible, and that you use every situation. If you've got a wall that faces north, for instance, no? Which way do they face then? East, west, if one of them doesn't face north.
Yeah, one faces south and one faces...
north. Are they opposite each other?
No, it's like an L shape.
Oh, right, okay. So either west or east, yeah. So on one of those side walls, whichever way it's facing, try something like honeysuckle. We were talking to your daughter earlier.
Mm-hmm. My daughter, bizarrely, Maddie, is a very keen gardener.
She's really...
You try your best with kids, yeah, and they go off the rails.
So, you know, that way you're going to cater for moths. Hugely important factor in, you know, many more moths than there are butterflies. Plant a wildflower meadow in a pot. No reason why you shouldn't. Plant underneath it some bulbs that are going to take over from it in the spring. But make them nice wildy bulbs, perhaps our own Narcissus, pseudo-Narcissus, you know, Wordsworth's daffodil. No, just you can get hold of it, you can buy it. And then what kind of plants do you like?
Colour, she said.
You like colour. Yeah. You like colour. So, great, because I think people often mistakenly think that if they plant ornamental plants, that somehow they're not as good for bees and butterflies as ornamentals. They are. The only place they let you down is in part the other part of the life cycle of insects. So, for instance, you don't really want caterpillars grazing on you. And, you know, they prefer to go and find a nettle patch somewhere rather than do that. But in terms of nectar and pollen...
It'd be quite nice to get some dead wood in there somewhere as well, if you can. You know, some old stumps or even a log with a hollow in it. And in the shadiest, dampest bit, which it doesn't sound as if you have much of, try and use that instead of using a pot in places. You can use that to plant the plants in. And as you water the plants, that will help the dead wood slowly rot away. And you do get the bugs and the beetles coming in, and they will live in there for that little window of opportunity in their life. But at least they'll come into your garden and they will live on everything else and with everything else as well. And you'll suddenly create this little haven. Just keep going with it.
And the most important plant you've got to plant, as far as I'm concerned, and you could do that in a pot or just take up one of the flagstones or whatever they are, is ivy. Yeah. Ivy and let it climb, because as soon as ivy starts to climb, it starts to flower. And those flowers are rich in pollen. Are they rich in nectar? I'm not sure. But, yeah. But also they'll be followed by berries, which blackbirds and all those towny birds, you know, will come and tuck in. You get quite a few pigeons as well, but never mind.
And go up. Don't ever just plant one climber. You know, get another climber going through it. So get a rose and a wisteria and a, you know, a clematis. Get them all going up there. You know, use the height as much as you possibly can.
But so you can do them all on the same wall?
Oh, yeah, twist them up together.
Yeah, and each other. They use each other as hosts.
And you'll have a flowering period, you know, from the start to the end of the season. You get a repeat flowering rose through there and you'll be as happy as Christmas.
And if you can, plant a single rose because it will give you lots more pollen. Lots of double flowers are so confused and they actually give up their pollen to create extra petals. So not only can the bees not get through there, but even if they do, they're disappointed.
Wow. I'm really looking forward to seeing your garden next year. I've got a nettle patch. Right.
Have you?
It's hugely important. It's an abandoned garden. It's smaller than yours, but it is abandoned. Question over here, I think.
I'm Liz. I bought 5 of the new Digitalis Firebird this year. And whilst they all look absolutely beautiful and really big and lush, they're not going up, so they're not going to flower. So what am I doing wrong?
Don't look at me.
So you bought them as rosettes?
I bought them. They were probably about that big. It was in May, just after Chelsea. Just been watching them, watering them well. We put them in the best soil we could. And they're growing beautifully, but they're not going up.
For those of us who don't know, what should they look like?
Right, it's a foxglove, Digitalis. You know, after digits, because the children like putting the fingers in the flowers, don't they? But this is a new sort of selection, which I'm not mad keen on in some ways, because although they're very beautiful, they don't produce any seed. I think they what you describe as short-lived perennials, but they are exceedingly beautiful. But I suspect that you've just been sold young plants and that they probably won't flower until next year. So they sound as though they're doing tremendously well, and they're obviously got lots of love and care. You could try as well just our straightforward native foxglove, which is the most wonderful plant, great for bumblebees. But then you've got to, it's a biennial, so you've got to sow it 1 year and sow it again the next year. First year it'll make a rosette, second year it'll flower, but then it'll die. But meanwhile, you've got new plants to plant out. Or try a couple of the perennial ones like Virginia or those lovely bronzy ones.
We go with the native foxglove all the time and we've continually got it in the borders and it just comes up. And what makes it really nice is the borders become really dynamic because you'll never have them in the same place. You know, they'll go through their cycle. But you've got next year's population coming on. And at the moment, the seeds are just ripening, so the gardeners at Starred will be rattling them through the borders. And it's a lovely thing to do. And you get the different shades of pink, and then you'll get the odd burst of white in one of the borders as well, and it's really nice.
Exactly. It's really exciting to see sometimes. We've got quite a lot of forestry land around us. And when they've felled, you know, there's no sign of anything growing underneath at all. But when they fell the next year, up they come and the whole hillside is just pink and white and beautiful. So good luck and I'm sure they'll be absolutely fine.
Question at the back.
Hello, my name's Mike. My wife has the green fingers and I've got a spade. We run a fairly standard estate-sized garden and every time we see a new plant, we try and find somewhere for it. Now, my question is, if you were to start from scratch with an average sort of domestic garden, would you go for a formal colour palette and try and get things fairly standard, or would you just go for a total mixture?
Alan, what would you do?
I always go with my gut. There's a lovely expression that I carry through from the 18th century, and it says, paint as you plant and as you garden design. And go with the place and go with yourself. Otherwise, you're gardening for someone else. You know, you can get all the inspiration you want out of books, but you need to know what you like. And if you see a plant that you really love, you'll plant it. And you'll always have that story, that cup of coffee with your wife or a friend associated with buying that plant. And it's in the garden and it becomes a library of memories. And I think it's...
Or somebody giving it to you.
Or somebody giving it to you. And I think that's what's really nice about gardening. But it was Alexander Pope said that. Paint as you plant and as you garden design. And so go with the flow. You may well have elements of formality in there. You may well have elements of informality and a bit of wildflower meadow in a pot, whatever it is, but it'll be your place.
And presumably it has to be a negotiation. I get the impression you're doing the work, Mike. This is certainly how it works in my parents' garden. My parents are quite elderly now, but still, my mum decides and my dad has to make it happen. And so there is an element of discussion, usually about the placement of broad beans in this particular case at home. It's a negotiation, yeah?
Oh, yeah, always, yeah. Always.
That's a fairly simple negotiation with the broad beans, but this sounds a bit more complicated. I completely agree with you. I think garden is the one place where we get to express ourselves. Isn't it? You know, everybody does. I mean, some of us are lucky enough to be able to write or present or whatever. But for the great majority of people, if you've got a garden, it's yours. It's yours.
Yeah. Every day you look at it, you'll have a cup of tea looking at it, and you're making lists of work to do out there. But it's your place.
No, you know, I have gin and tonic in mind.
Oh, do you? Yeah. Gin and tonic for breakfast, if only.
No, yeah. We've got this huge stone in our garden. It's really enormous. It was from a farm down the road, and the farmer who brought it 40 years ago, he actually took it out of the Land Rover himself and plonked it down. I don't know how he did it, but it's gigantic. And my mum she's been there for quite a long time now, but she used to visit us frequently, and it was her stone. It was Jeannie's stone. And that's where she did drink her first cup of tea and her last gin and tonic. that was it. I think the only proviso to what you've said is that the plants you've chosen like growing there, like the conditions. I mean, that's the only thing. Don't ever try and I shouldn't be so prescriptive, should I? But don't ever try and grow camellias if you've got, you know, and change the conditions just to cater for them.
Don't argue with Mother Nature because you'll lose. You will lose.
Every time.
Yeah.
Let's take another question. Can you stick your hand in there? So, lady on the front here with the dog. Oh, no, I've woken him up. Sorry, he was fast asleep till I said that. Okay, that's the question from the dog.
Yeah.
My name is Sheila. We went to the Gardeners World Show at Birmingham. And I bought a number of perennials and planted them in the garden. They were in flower, but a lot of them have died off. Is it something I've done, or were they forced, or will they come up next year?
What were they?
Echinacea. That has come up. There was one that was a white flower, but I can't remember what it was. What's the yellow one?
The white one like? Little and dainty or big?
Yes. Little dainty flowers, and the stems are now white and the flowers have finished.
Sometimes one of the problems is that I used to run a nursery for 30 years, and I was really thrilled by the end of that time to find that people were interested in the provenance of plants, where plants came from, how they grew in the wild or their relatives. Because initially people would, and I did too, and still do sometimes, would buy because something was in flower and looked wonderful, without any regard really to whether or not it was going to work. So I think the thing is that a lot of nurseries are interested in point of sale. Of course you are. You know, you want your plant to be looking at its best in time for the NEC show or Hampton Court or whatever it is. And sometimes plants are grown in, again, I was talking to Maddie about this, are grown in either peat-based or peat substitutes, multi-purpose compost. So they look absolutely, and they fed and watered at exactly the right time, kept in the right conditions. And when you put them into your ground, even you've got clay, especially so with clay soils, You dig a hole, you might improve the soil around about, but you tend to plonk the plant in, backfill it, firm it down, water it. Now, sometimes you'll get a drought and the soil will shrink away and the soil that the plant's in will also shrink. So there's never any real contact made. On the other hand, sometimes you'll get floods and the whole thing will act as a sump and all that water will gather. So I think whenever you're putting a new plant in, first of all, if it's got fibrous roots, break them up, because that encourages them to make. And make the stuff they're going into as like the stuff in the pot as possible, so it's a gradual transition.
It's a really stressful time for a plant. You know, it's been on display in this wonderful show in Birmingham, and then you chuck it in a bag, take it home in the back of your car, you know, stress it out good and proper, take it out of a pot, which it has been targeted at that particular show. And as Carol said, the roots are just perfect, it's looking amazing, and then you'd stick it in the ground. That plant has had daily care and daily water and, you know, well looked after for a long time to that point. And it's a really stressful transition. And like you said, it suddenly decides it's got this acre of clay to try and explore to find some nutrients in. So the last thing it's going to want to do is perform and display and be a wonderful flowering plant. It's going to want to set root and really establish itself. So once it does establish itself, it should come back and do... It should behave itself, but keep an eye on it.
It's a very unnatural place to be for a plant, isn't it? In a pot, when you think about it. Plants belong in the earth. Yeah. You know, that's where they like.
And that's its ambition.
Living.
So once it gets there, it's like when we plant trees. Once they get there, that's all they want to do, you know, let those roots go.
So try growing a few plants of your own from seed, because there's loads of good perennials you can grow from seed, really. Smashes, and then you'll have not just one, but you'll have several. You'll also have an investment in the plant because you've nurtured it. So, and then try them in different places and, you know, really prepare your soil well before you put them in.
Okay, let's get another question.
Hi, my name's Pat. I've got an evergreen Japanese variegated spotted laurel. I don't know what the Latin name for it is, I can't tell. But it's half of it's died. It's in a pot, like a big barrel. I planted it last year, but this year I put a load of busy lizzies around there. Would that have caused a problem? Half of it's died, the other half's fine.
Is it an orcuba?
I think it is a cuba, isn't it? Yeah.
It's in a shade.
So today we've had mint and a cuba killed. That's good going, that is, isn't it?
It's pretty good going, yeah.
So just half of the plant is dead, is it?
The plant has died and the other half's fine.
And there's no fracturing at the base?
No, I've looked.
Nothing like that?
Would it be some, you know, that mealybug thing? Would that
go into the... If it's just half of it, it would be really...
So
any kind of pest is going to affect
the whole lot.
Be fairly uniform, yeah.
And don't blame busy lizzies. I mean, they've got a lot to answer for. But...
They can't kill a cuba.
Killer busy lizzies.
Could it have fractured under the soil then, I suppose?
Well, it might have. It might. That's the only thing I can think of, because if it's died uniformly on one side, then the vascular system, so the food system coming up through the plant,
right,
has been cut off. I mean, you might have raised the soil a little bit too high on one side of it.
Ah, okay.
If you were putting the plants in.
Right.
But well, they're hard to kill.
If I just, I'll just cut it off. I'll pull the soil away and have a look underneath, I suppose.
You could do that, but if it's dead, you know, like Carol said, you know, the best thing to do is
take it off and the rest is growing, it'll be fine. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
I don't like orcuba. I think it's a paraquat plant. It always looks as though somebody's
been sprayed it with chemical, yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. Can I tell you about something interesting that we did? I've just done a programme with Channel 5. But it was a really interesting programme because we went to visit four good gardens, Great Dixter, Grave Tie, John Massey's lovely garden at Ashwood in Birmingham, near Wolverhampton, Albrighton, and a garden in Lancashire, Arabella Lennox-Boyd's garden in Gresgarth, all vastly different from one another. But one of the things that we did at Grave Tie was they were trying to, smashing gardener there, nearly as nice as you, a bloke called Tom Coward. And one of the things they were trying to do you know who William Robinson was? It's William Robinson's garden. So not as magnificent as your...
William Robinson was great,
but he was an Irishman too, wasn't he?
Is he Victorian or is he?
Yes, Victorian, and right, he lived to be 90 odd, so right the way through actually. But he wrote, funnily enough, it was the English Flower Garden, wasn't it? And he was an Irishman, so I can't quite work that out. But anyway, in this one area, they wanted to reinstate something which Robinson had, which was a small, wasn't a cherry orchard, but it was a series of cherry trees. But it had been in cut grass, mown grass. On the other side, there's an apple orchard and lots of wildflowers. So we cut all, or they cut, all those wildflowers at the right time, at seeding time, and because this was last year, and then moved it, lock, stock and barrel, to the other side and tossed it all around the place. So all that seed dropped down to turn this cherry orchard into a cherry orchard in the middle of the wild meadow.
And that's a local seed bank, so you're not importing seed from anywhere else. It's a local bank of seed, so you recreate what was there naturally.
Yes.
And something that we found this year, we left an area at Stourhead up by the temple on the hill. We left it go to wild grass this year, and it hasn't been let go for 30, 40 years.
Yeah.
And we had three different types of orchid come up in there, just waiting underneath the lawnmower.
Yeah.
And then suddenly the mower stops and up they come. So there's a treasure in there somewhere.
Because that seed can last. I always used to wonder what a seed bank was. I really used to ponder and think perhaps that... where I ought to keep all the money I've got.
But, lasts a bit longer.
But they can go on for, well, nobody really knows how long, do they? They even had, I worked in Rome once drawing amphora, a different kind of job, but we came across lots of archaeologists and they found corn that had been Roman corn and it actually germinated. So 2,000 years.
Very
old.
Important now. Part of I do farming programs. Very important part is using heritage wheats to actually breed new varieties to cope with new weather patterns and so on. So we must never lose them. Right, I'm going to move on quickly to a question at the back there. Yes,
thank you. My name's Rowena. We've lived with our garden for almost 30 years. And it was basically very heavy clay, which we've improved over the years by adding lots of compost and sand. I'd be interested in your view on a couple of things. First of all, when I buy new plants, I generally pot them into bigger pots with good quality compost before actually putting them in the ground, maybe the following year. That was my first question. The second question, we brought with us some lilac, and the lilac is shooting up all over the place. And other than cutting it back or digging it out, I'm just wondering what may be the best way to actually manage our lilac that would probably take over the garden if we let it.
Well, you could give it to me. Let's do the first question first. So from a pot to a bigger pot and then into the garden.
And thence.
And thence.
It's always nice to have the opportunity to use that word, isn't it?
Like we were hinting at earlier, the healthier the plant is when it goes into the ground, the better. So by putting it into a bigger pot, you're stimulating more roots, you're giving it more chance to develop a fine, really healthy root ball, so you're putting it into the ground in as good condition as possible. Timing is critical, ideally not planting when they're in flower, they're already quite stressed, putting a lot of energy into those kind of things, so timing is quite critical. I think you're doing a good thing there, especially if you're going out into clay. The garden I worked on in Essex was clay. Lots and lots of clay. So I moved to Stourhead where there's green sand, beautiful soil. So it's your other option is just move. You know, it's thank you.
But it's quite radical.
It is. If it's in good condition, you know, you're halfway there already.
Okay. And lilac, apart from letting me loose, what would you do?
Is it multi-stemmed? Is it suckering everywhere all over the garden? And is there one kind of central stem to the tree? Is it becoming a tree?
Yes, it was two or three, but we've managed that to cut it back to just one. Oh, by the way, we did manage to kill mint this year.
Yes!
There must be a club.
It's a skill.
Lilac is quite tricky because once it started suckering, you know, you're going to have that mat, that kind of fibrous mat underneath the soil, which is desperate desperate to come up through. So you either decide that you're going to have a love-hate relationship with it and manage it and plant, you know, plant over the top of it and just make sure that it's controlled, but try and create those two or three healthy plants so you've got some structure in the garden.
Will
as
it
well.
Be grown on its own rootstock?
Well, that's the other thing.
What are the flowers like?
When it's in flower, it's absolutely stunning, but that's the main tree.
Yeah, but what's it like? Is it an ordinary, straightforward, pale lilac?
Yes.
So it's probably growing on its own roots, yeah. Isn't it? If you had a fancy variety, you know, a big double one or a deep purple one or a white one, then it might have been grafted, in which case these suckers that are coming up would be the, you know, the species, the wildy one. But in your case, you've got the species anyway, so they're bound to be.
And they're quite robust in your situation, so you can manage those suckers all the way back. And the other thing to remember is the more suckers that are covered in leaf, the more energy that plant is getting. So, you know, it's just feeding itself, so keep the suckers off it and you'll...
Is that true?
Right. Yeah.
Right, rather than... Because at first thought you'd think that those suckers were actually taking energy from it, but they're not, are they?
They're
bringing in all that chlorophyll. And
Should we therefore just kind of dig out all that root system that seems to be developing?
If you can.
Delegate it. There's a man with a spade that sits next to you. Yeah.
That's going to be his summer then, isn't it?
Hello, my name's Anne. 4 years ago, I planted saffron. As yet, I haven't had any flowers. Is there anything I can do this year, like tomato feed or something, to encourage flowering?
Where did you plant them? They're bulbs. It's a kind of crocus, saffron crocus. She could move to Spain.
You could move to Spain, yeah.
Where did you plant them, Anne?
A raised bed. And I have put a homemade compost over the top as well, because apparently they've got to be quite deep.
Deep but poor, I would say. They don't want rich compost at all, because that will just... What you're after is the flowers, because presumably you're growing them so you can make your own saffron, though, because it's very expensive stuff, isn't it? But where they're grown... Saffron Walden, they actually used to produce it there, didn't they?
Yeah, they've got saffron churches because they made so much money, they built churches.
And it's thin soil and probably quite alkaline.
I live in Herne Bay and it's London clay.
Yeah, you need to try and emulate what occurs naturally. So obviously not London clay. So did you say it was in a pot? You were growing it in pots, so you're trying to grow it?
No, it's in the ground. Yeah.
Raised bed.
Is it in a raised bed?
Yes.
Yeah. Then dig out your bulbs, first of all, over winter, and then get rid of your good soil and put some rubbish in. Really, you know, limey rubble, lots of sand.
The clay is rubble, I can tell you. It's awful.
Make it miserable and it will want to flower.
Hello, my name is Hilary. I'd love to grow some spring bulbs and some plants for cutting, but I have a huge pest in my garden that tramples everything. And I wonder if you can recommend something that is sort of fairly resilient to 30 kilos of dog.
Yeah, a cat maybe?
A hawthorn hedge by the looks of it.
I tried prickly plants, but it doesn't seem to bother her, like aubergines and things.
Well, you can't find bulbs that are impervious to dogs, can you? No, there's no such thing as a sort of spiteful bulb.
Yeah. I think a boundary is the answer, really. Some kind of boundary between your pest and your prized possession bulbs.
They did a sort of dog-friendly garden, was it at Hampton Court a couple of years ago? But in actual fact, because they allowed dogs in it, the dogs didn't go into the main part of the garden. They just went into this rather wild bit at the back. So it was a bit of a cheat. My garden is just too overpowering for my dogs, so they tend to stick to the paths a bit. But they're just Lakeland Terriers. They're just little dogs, but it has to be a boundary.
In my own garden at home, but it's, you know, I had a German Shepherd and a Collie, and they were quite active dogs. But I, you know, hooped my beds off in the spring when they're coming up, and then once everything is through, you know, I take the hoops down because the dogs are quite habitual, And, you know, if they know they can't run through there, they will tend to run around it. I've just got the collie at the moment, and he's established his route around the garden at home, so he's not too bad.
Hi, my name's Kim. My neighbour has an L-shaped garden, and she has an L-shaped beds in front of the corner. And in the corner is a honeysuckle, which is about 7 foot tall. Looked beautiful last year, and this year it was completely covered in black. And I put sort of washing up liquid spray on it, and it hasn't been helpful. And so I chopped back a lot of the dead, and now I've made it look awful.
So is this your honeysuckle or your neighbour's?
It's sort of in my garden. So it's my neighbour's, but
right.
She's got the fencing, and I've got the sort of shared garden.
And you've got the honeysuckle.
I've got the honeysuckle hanging over, and she's got it in her garden. And I said to her, we should just chop it right down there.
And do you know what honeysuckle it is?
No.
No. What colour flowers on it?
Yellow.
Yellow. I would be inclined to follow your kind of your route of cutting it back, because the sooty mould is will be on the foliage, and you do need to clean the foliage up and clean the place as much as you can, so when it does reshoot, the plant is as healthy as possible, and it's not going to carry the sooty mould through its life cycle into next year again.
So your neighbour's going to have to do that.
Well, I'll knit round to hers and just...
Oh, she won't mind. Oh, great. No, well,
just do ask before you...
And get rid of it. It's a fungus, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
So burn the stuff you take off it and make sure, you know, you're really clean around the roots.
Okay.
But since it was so vigorous, there's no reason why it shouldn't be again.
It should come back quite well.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm really sorry. That's all we've got time for here in the tent. Can we thank Alan and Carol so very much for sharing the joys of gardening?
Thanks for listening to this extract from the many talks and debates that happened in the National Trust Theatre at BBC Countryfile Live 2019. To learn more about this and other audio programmes from the National Trust, go to nationaltrust.org.uk/podcasts. And to purchase your ticket for BBC Countryfile Live 2020, go to countryfilelive.com. This is a National Trust podcast recorded at BBC Countryfile Live 2019.